Well, I promised I'd talk about state politics, and we're going to do that because wherever we live, we tend to think state governments and state social structures are all the same, and thus state voters are all the same. After all, McDonald's is everywhere. So are places like Costco and Olive Garden. We consume mostly national media and even international media and entertainment. The internet is, after all, called the World Wide Web, right? But all the states were settled differently at different times and have unique political structures and social structures, even though we live in a national and international environment. Now, I'm not going to talk about all the states in this podcast, but I am going to focus on Minnesota, and maybe we'll talk about Texas a little bit. I live in Minnesota, but I think the lesson is to take some time and investigate your state's unique social and political history to better understand what is going on in your state's politics. In podcast 786, the Bob Davis Podcasts. We're going to talk about political issues a little bit in this podcast, and one of the issues I think that's really important is people, the quality of the things that are in your house. People will really, they'll go around the block to buy organic detergent or some kind of non-chemical washing, whatever you use to wash your dishes, dishwashing detergent. But then they'll drink water out of the tap. And the thing about it is, I do not drink the tap water in my town. First of all, it tastes terrible. And then there's always this question of possible pollution from decades ago. So you have toxins in the water. They're odorless, tasteless, and colorless. And then what they put in it to make it safe just is not good for you. So I spend a lot of money on a bottled water. I don't like it. But really, it's about this question of health. And so my friend Joe Berg was telling me the other day that he can make my tap water more pure and better tasting than bottled water. This is the Water Butler water purification system. They can give you a giant one that will cover all the water in your house, or they can put it just literally under your sink. They will come up with a water purification system that will end your dependence on bottled water forever, and they can do it relatively easily. Now, once you stop buying bottled water, you know, it's more affordable. Call 763-286-8328. That's 763-286-8328. And ask for Joe Berg. He would love to talk to you about making your water purer and making it healthier for you to live in your house, especially if you live in St. Louis Park, Rogers, Maple Grove, Edina, Plymouth, or Minnetonka. It is time to purify your water right from the source with the Water Butler. They have 65 years of experience with plumbing, 30 years of experience with water filtration systems. 763-286-8328. 763-286-8328. Click on the banner at the top of the page at the Bob Davis Podcasts. Now, if you're in the market for an American manufacturer, especially with all the trade protection, the foreign manufacturing, and the volatility from all these tariffs, you might want to think about DepoStar, American Design, Engineering, and Manufacturing. Visit their website at DepoStar.com. That's DepoStar, DepoStar.com. All right, so here's where I'm going to start. First of all, I want to say that I'm going to talk about some things regarding Minnesota politics, which might be considered harsh, and some people might take it the wrong way. I'm not trying to offend or hurt. I am trying to talk about the politics in the state where I live directly. And so some people might be offended by some of the things I say about Minnesota politics. Social life and politics in Minnesota. But almost everywhere I go, I hear people say things like, why don't these guys do what they say they'll do? And there's dissatisfaction with politics, especially on the Republican side in Minnesota, with these politicians that lie and don't do what they say that they're going to do. And I would imagine, in fact, at least with my Democrat friends who are struggling with the light rail situation in Minneapolis and St. Paul, or the people who are against mining interests in northern Minnesota, and you have a Democrat governor who greenlighted a mining project up there, you have people who don't understand why these politicians never do what they say that they're going to do. So this is kind of the basis of this podcast, and I'm going to start with asking you to review podcast 727, which is about Minnesota's unique and progressive history in politics. And I don't want to go back through or relitigate that whole podcast and talk about all the things that I said, because that one I actually researched and wrote up. But to make a long story short, Minnesota has a unique history because of the people that settled it and the politics that came with them, and because of the time it was settled. So Minnesota became a state in, what, 1856 or 1858, I think. And by the time it had been a state for less than 40 years, so the late 1890s, the Industrial Revolution was in full swing. And because Minnesota was at that time primarily a farm state, the farmers, especially in western Minnesota and in eastern North and South Dakota, what became eastern North and South Dakota, were struggling with banks. They were struggling with exports. They were struggling with agricultural issues. And so a populist as well as socialist / communist collective movement started in western Minnesota and North and South Dakota. The socialist movement was called the Grange. And then, of course, you had labor movements as well, with mining up in the northern part of the state. So we have a unique history because Minnesota is an industrial state, but only in the sense of the mining. Yes, there's industry in Minnesota, but Minnesota's history is banking and agriculture, and it is far less industrial in its history and development than, let's say, Illinois or Pennsylvania or New York, right? And that's I think, a key thing. So the thing that I pointed out in that podcast is that the Republican Party in Minnesota, going back to the early 1900s, was progressive. So the Republican Party wanted to use government to fix problems. Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive. And so what I'm saying is you had the Democrat Farm Labor Group, and you had Republicans who were very progressive at the time. And there was a lot of populist politics in the state of Minnesota, South and North Dakota, but especially North Dakota, around that time period. So one of the ways that you can contrast Minnesota is to compare Minnesota's history with a little bit of Texas history. And I bring up Texas because Texas is thought of as a Valhalla by Minnesota Republicans. Why can't we be like Texas? And how come Texas is so Republican and we struggle up here and we want to turn Minnesota red, on and on and on? Why can't we have what they have? Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, Texas was settled earlier than Minnesota. So the very first people to go into Texas were French. They came over from Louisiana. And then as the Mexican government became independent from Spain, basically squatters started to come in from different parts of the United States. The founders of the state of Texas were from Missouri. You had Scots-Irish coming in from Alabama and Mississippi and Tennessee and Kentucky that moved into Texas, and they had a completely different socialization as residents of West Virginia and Tennessee and so forth, because that was the frontier in the 1820s. They moved to Texas, and they were actually squatters, and then later Mexico, and remember, Texas didn't exist. It was Mexico. So they were squatting in Mexican territory, and the Mexican government said, we will allow immigration, because they were concerned about all of these squatters. And the other thing about Texas I think is unique is that Texas has a rich ranching history, and later with oil, obviously a history with natural resources as well. So they're a ranching and oil in terms of natural resources. So there's a little bit of a similarity there to Minnesota, because Minnesota's natural resources figure in the northern part of the state. The other thing is the Homestead Act. So in 1862, Abraham Lincoln signed the Homestead Act into law. Without getting too complicated, you could get 100 acres, and if you could improve the land, then it would be yours eventually. So the idea of the 100-acre thing was to bring European immigrants to the U.S. well after Texas was settled. So the difference with Texas is that they came from a different part of the world. So they were Scots-Irish, and they were really residents of the United States. Western provinces, basically Western territories. They moved to what then was Mexico and what became Texas, both as an independent country and then as a state of the United States. Up here, it's different. Our immigrants to this part of the world came later. They came in the 1860s and 1870s. They came to the mining from Eastern Europe and England in different parts of the northern tier of the United States because they had experience mining. And the Germans and the Norwegians and the Swedes all came to this part of the country and came to become small farmers. So small farmers are different from ranchers in that they are different disciplines. It's still agriculture, but there were a lot of small farmers in Minnesota. Moreover, they were European immigrants. And with them, they brought these ideas, which were prevalent because what was going on in Europe in the 1850s and 1860s and 1840s was the conservative elite. Now, this isn't, you know, capitalist versus progressive. This is about European politics. They were trying to basically retake and consolidate power. So you had movements in Germany and in France and in different parts of Europe that were basically about consolidating power, and they were basically dictatorial or parliamentary dictatorial movements that forced a lot of people out because of their religious viewpoints or because they wanted to be free. And so that's why a lot of these German socialists and a lot of these, you know, Swedish and Norwegian people came with this idea of these basic social ideas and these basic political ideas that fit into their own unique social histories in Norway and Sweden and other places, as well as later Irish and more German immigrants in Minnesota. So we have a completely different history in the state of Minnesota than we do in Texas in terms of the types of people that settled, their attitudes, and the environment in those places. It is worth pointing out that the largest Indian battle in U.S. history, this is between Native Americans and settlers in the United States, occurred in 1860 at New Ulm when Prussian immigrants and German immigrants had to deal with harassment, and eventually the Indians in that area decided they were going to wipe out New Ulm. And it was a Prussian officer who set up the defenses of the city, and they were able to beat back the Indians. And that was the largest Indian battle in U.S. history, despite all of the history that we read about Tombstone and about, Custer in at the Battle of Little Bighorn and all that stuff. And this, we think of the Indians' battles as taking place down in Comanche territory or in Apache territory, but they pale in contrast to the size of that conflict in the summer of 1860 when the immigrants, who spoke no English, by the way, had to protect their farms. Meanwhile, Washington had other things on its mind because, as you know, in 1860, that was the beginning of the U.S. Civil War. So the Minnesota political history is very different from these other states that people say, how come we can't be Republican? And where your people come from and what they bring with them in terms of their political history, their social history, their religion, their upbringing, and everything else has a lot to do with the eventual political makeup of a state. The other thing about Minnesota is it has been very insular, meaning that we are focused on ourselves. We were isolated from the rest of the country. I think the weather has a lot to do with isolating Minnesota from the rest of the country. But back in the day, this was just a giant farm to be and a mine, to be quite honest. And no one would ever come up here unless they were going to go hunting, or they were on their way to Canada, which nobody ever went to, or they were on their way further west. And so Minnesota tended to be isolated, and it contributed to the insularity. Also, we had a lot of people here who spoke different languages. And there are great stories about for example, there was a town and my friend Tommy Mischke talks about this a lot. There was a town in Minnesota that actually sided with the Germans in World War I. They didn't think anything of it. And there was a whole issue because the whole town was German. And people were like, you know, what are we going to do about these? What are they going to do? Are they going to revolt and everything else? Which is, you know, people here today are probably surprised to remember this, because if I remember the name of the town, I'll mention it. But so this is a unique and interesting and an interesting culture, as interesting in Minnesota as the culture in Texas. And here's the other thing. So the culture in northern Michigan is also a mining culture, but they came from England. And the culture in Illinois, the political culture in Illinois, the personal culture in Illinois is different ethnically. It was settled at a different time, and it's dominated by a giant urban area like Chicago. So the original settlers in Minnesota were from New England, Massachusetts, and New York State, and New Hampshire, and literally the state of New England. And they came here with the idea of creating a public-private arrangement where the banks and the towns would work together, and that's our history. And I found that in some of my research, and I was like, there it is, that the largest employer in the state of Minnesota is still the Mayo Clinic, which is a public-private partnership. And if you work your way down, the larger employers happen to be public-private partnerships, and nobody in this state ever seems to worry or think about these quote-unquote public-private partnerships that might be considered an anathema to capitalism in other places. So that's a little sketch of Minnesota history, some of which is probably wrong, most of which is probably right, but it sets the stage for a larger discussion of why quote-unquote conservatives struggle so much in this state. Now, look, one of the big issues in Minnesota is medical insurance and medical care. And when you think about it, when you think about the whole thing, you think it's a hopeless mess. There's nothing anyone can do. But there is a market-based idea, and it is called the wedge. And when we talk about the wedge, we got to talk about Twyla Brays at the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. She's amazing, and she is the person that created something called the wedge. She's going to explain it.
We're building an alternative infrastructure of freedom for patients and doctors. In 2016, we launched the Wedge of Health Freedom, which can be found at jointhewedge.com. This is a place that lists all the doctors who are no longer involved with government or insurance companies, and they receive cash, check, or charge from patients. So they have a direct private contractual relationship with the patient. It's patient friendly, it's pocketbook friendly, and it's privacy friendly. And this is our way of bringing the practice of medicine back to where it should be. It's our way of returning simplicity and affordability and patient friendliness, as well as a confidential patient-doctor relationship back to the practice of medicine, back to healthcare. This is our way of saving patients and doctors from the system of today, which does not care, is not kind, and is not compassionate. When you walk into the office of a doctor on the wedge, you will know right away exactly what the prices are. You will be paying either monthly or you will be paying per service. But there will be no overlay of costs from extra paperwork or billing or CPT codes or trying to get permission from your insurance company. It's all just between you and the doctor, making it affordable and making it personable and friendly.
The wedge grows every day, and more people should know about it. To learn more, visit the Citizens Council for Health Freedom at cchfreedom.org or click on the Big Brother in the Exam Room banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcasts.com. So in 2018, the Minnesota Republican Party decided they were going to have a campaign to, quote unquote, turn Minnesota red. The Republican brand, or the red brand, carries with it a lot of negatives for most people across the country, even those who support it. I don't want to get into that in this podcast other than to simply say, when you consider the history of Minnesota, which is very much about public-private partnerships working together and very moderate, and I'll get to why in a second, the idea of turning the state red might not go over very well with people in this state, because even if they're Republicans, they're not like the kinds of Republicans you find in the South, in Mississippi or South Carolina or Florida and those kinds of places. So what has happened in Minnesota in terms of political movements, and why Minnesota seems to struggle to elect Republicans, especially in the Twin Cities and especially up in the northern part of the state, and even with the advent of the idea of turning pivot counties or counties that would normally vote Democrat voting for Trump or voting for Republican candidates. Even with the potential for rural voters in, let's say, the first district down in the southern part of the state voting for Republican candidates, it tends to be an uphill battle to create or to activate really conservative groups of people in Minnesota because there aren't any. And what you end up with in this environment is political movements that operate in a vacuum and or political movements that are scattershot, completely random, and not based on any real assessments of what people in the state, and I'm talking about Minnesota in particular, consider to be real things that need to be fixed. So when you start talking about what the real issues are, you can only determine those things from social research, which is meticulously and carefully conducted. And what we end up with are movements that come up with their own language to access their own people. They don't aren't using language that actually addresses the people who might be potential voters in the state. And they are not descriptive of the actual issues. For example, what is a good conservative? What does the word conservative mean? What is a good Republican? What does the word Republican mean? Does that mean that union blue-collar workers are quote-unquote progressives? And then on top of that, especially on the right, you have ethereal concepts like freedom, and on the left, you have ethereal concepts like justice. And there is a huge role of religion in particular on the right in this state and in many states. It has often been said that a Minnesota Republican is a Texas Democrat. And then we have what I would refer to as passive-aggressive tendencies in socialization in Minnesota. We call it Minnesota Nice. So if you're listening and you're from out of state, if you're a Minnesotan, you probably don't even understand this. But I found a list, a great list of passive-aggressive tendencies in Minnesota's socialization, and I think they're really, really, really true. Polite friendliness. People in Minnesota will be very friendly and nice to you, but they are not interested in being your friends. And just because they are friendly and polite does not mean that they want to have any future obligation with you. You might come from a state where you meet somebody at work and you say, hey, yada, 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 you know, hey, we're friends, let's go out for beers, or let's, you know, I hear you're having a barbecue this weekend, and you were expecting an invitation, but you won't get one from a Minnesotan because they may not, they have their high school friends and their church friends and their friends in the community, but for them to invite people over that they don't know is another thing entirely. And it also affects business. It affects a lot of things in this state. Here's another one. Aversion to conflict and confrontation. And this is so true. Minnesotans do not like confrontation. One of the things that I was taught a long time ago is that confrontation is something that you should actually want, because it's the conflict and it's the friction that comes from conflict that is actually part of the creative process, especially in business. If you have a problem in your business and it's a conflict, to solve it, you have to go through that conflict. And you can't be afraid of conflict because you won't be able to engage and solve problems. If you have an aversion to conflict and confrontation, you can't solve any problems. And Minnesota Nice, which is often what they call this passive-aggressive behavior, makes it impossible to confront and conflict so that you can solve problems. There is an unwillingness to get feedback that actually does anything. And what ends up happening is people then find disagreement to be really unfortunate and divergent ideas to be unfortunate, and they just won't, simply will not participate. And if you confront them, they will often go and tell your boss that you're a bad person or that you're mean when you weren't mean. In fact, you might not have even raised your voice except to say, why are you doing it that way? And that freaks them out. And I've had that experience. There is a tendency towards understatement, where people have a difficulty to tell people when they have done something that is bad, or even better, to give somebody a compliment because they might get a big head, which I think is great. Here's another. People will talk amongst themselves, but you will never know that you have upset them or that you have progressed past the point where they're going to help you anymore. And the person that's the target of this will never know. A disinclination to make a fuss or stand out. This is also involved with the conflict. They do not want people to know that they are upset or that they did something right. They may want to be acknowledged, but they want to be acknowledged in a super low-key way. It makes them uncomfortable to be singled out for either praise or criticism. Emotional restraint. You know, people always, how are you doing? Oh, pretty good. You know, they don't really want to if you go, here's an example. I witnessed this on the street in Chicago, you know, and if I've seen it once, I've seen 100 times. You see it in New York all the time. People have arguments on the street. They just throw down in the middle of the street and they have it out. You will never see that here. And if you do, there's a real problem. They are very self-deprecating, which is endearing. We Minnesotans tend to critique our own performances, and we are likely to undervalue or belittle ourselves, which makes us even more passive-aggressive, because then we want to be recognized, but we don't want to be recognized. And then resistance to change. People, again, I talked about this state being insular. People live in the same town, surrounded by the same people that they've had since they were babies. It makes them feel comfortable, and then they are suspicious of anything different and fearful of a lot of change. I'll give you an example. So Hometown Boys Made Good get a lot of press in Minnesota because they just love a hometown boy made good. But if you're from New York and you come here and you're an amazing person and you do something amazing, you're probably not going to get recognized for it, because they're going to recognize the Anoka County native or the Annandale native because they did something. Well, you know, she's just doing so good. And then, of course, passive aggressiveness, where there is a covert aggressiveness and it hides beneath the surface. So you will see people who are sullen, procrastinators, stubborn, and I've done it where I'm just not going to do it, but I'm not going to tell anybody because I don't want anybody to know what I'm thinking. This is the whole thing. So I don't know how we deal with it. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know what you're supposed to do. But if you are if you're an extrovert, if you come from another city where people, I worked in New York City, I came from Chicago. When I got to New York, when I got to Washington, D.C., you know, New York was amazing because people fight all their life to get to the big time. And if you do something that that prevents them, or if they feel that they could lose their big time job, they go crazy. And it's also, you know, creative intensity that is at the top because it's very competitive. I've seen chairs thrown through walls. I've seen people, you know, clear their desks. I've seen people throw things. And then 10 minutes later, everybody's sitting there having a drink. So it's very interesting. Here, if you ever demonstrated any kind of behavior like that, they would never speak to you again. So it's not a super aggressive and expressive place. It's passive aggressive. And that's extremely difficult when it comes to politics, because when you have problems to solve in politics and you invite conflict, you're dead before you get out of the gate, because they do not like conflict. They don't like negative political ads. They don't like it when people criticize each other. So if you're running for office and you want to criticize your opponent, well, you're going to have a lot of trouble doing that because they are not going to like it. And this is what goes on in the state in terms of solving problems. So we keep going back over the same ground again and again and again. And at least in this environment in Minnesota, creating a grassroots political movement based on conflict and resolution of conflict becomes highly problematic unless there's an issue that drives people into the movement that they're really upset about. Obamacare, abortion, taxes, or cops shooting people, some kind of chemical spill, or a pipeline issue, or something to that effect. And these are one-off issues that don't change the political environment. So you get these shard movements, these splinter movements that seem to be important, but they're not. And so our politics in Minnesota and the rest of the country, by extension, isn't really driven by ideals or principles. It's driven by identity, one-off issues, frustration, and anger. And the themes tend to be the elites, the deep state, the rest of the world is screwing us, we got to have some tariffs, voting against your own economic interest without knowing it, some kind of religious ideals, or on the left, it's I'm my brother's keeper. On the right, it has to do with reproductive things and morality and these kinds of things. And then, of course, racial themes that are a part of this. And that this is a fertile ground for populist types of politics, which is what we are seeing across the board, not just in the Republican Party. So what happens here is when you throw up the Constitution in this environment and you're going to go teach the Constitution and people are going to read the Constitution, then 6 weeks later, they're going to be an expert on the Constitution. It doesn't have anything to do with anything. And if anything, it's even worse, because they will use their knowledge of the Constitution to support only what they want to draw from their knowledge of the Constitution. And since they're not really constitutional scholars, when they actually confront a constitutional scholar, they're at sea. Some of the other factors that apply here are a lack of balanced education, ignorance when it comes to basic economics, ignorance of the rest of the world, ignorance of the complexity and the resentment of the complexity in policymaking, whether it's on defense or diplomacy or economics, because if you pull this string, then this string over here will be a problem. They yet resent authority, but at the same time, they want more authority to do the things that they want to get done. And this isn't just Minnesotans, by the way, but this is part of it. Confusion on how the system actually works, especially the newbies coming in and trying to be a part of the political process. It takes a long time to learn that everything you do as a basic political unit chair or a legislator or, a county chair is going to have an effect. And, people that get involved in politics want to do all these things. They want to be bigwigs and they want to make things happen, and then things happen and they don't work out the way that they thought they were going to work out. So the best thing is almost always to do nothing. And there's a lot of misplaced idealism and faith in religious ideas and government as a savior. You will often encounter people in politics in Minnesota on the right who will tell you about Jesus, and they don't understand politics, or they will allow their religion to color their economic ideas, let's say. And everything that they take in comes from one source. They won't look at anything that isn't Christian, let's say. And by the way, this isn't all of them, but these are things that I've encountered. And then finally, the democratization, which is not Democratic Party, but the popularizing of information on YouTube and social media and so forth and so on, has basically fueled these populist or radical ideas on both sides of the political spectrum. So what does that mean for politics, and why does that make it difficult? And I'm going to talk about Minnesota specifically. So running out and creating a political movement of some kind based on the Constitution, which I see a lot, doesn't do anything. Political movements based on ideals end up coalescing into cults of personality, whether it's Trump, Sanders, or Rourke, if you're a Democrat, Ron Paul, basically fall apart when the personality that drives them goes away. And after the personality fades, well, what have you left with? What are your principles? What are your ideas? Hence, when I interviewed Steve Drazkowski about the situation at the state capitol the other day, that he's caucusing with four other Republicans away from the larger Republican minority caucus in the House, he was reluctant. I don't want to get into the gory details. You'll hear that a lot in politics in Minnesota. Why? Because the face that these guys show you when they come and talk to your meeting, they're just really nice and they're real happy and they're glad to talk to you. And boy, you're right about that. And, Dave, I think it's really interesting that you brought that up. And here's what's going on. And they'll give you all kinds of give and take and talk about House bills and what they did and all this other stuff. And then they go back to the Capitol, and the way they talk to each other is not the way they talk to you. It is a very combative, a very nasty environment for the most part at the Capitol, especially among the Republicans. There is a lot of pecking order, there's a lot of bullying, and there's a lot of mean stuff, but you'll never see it. Because why? Well, they don't want to share that, and it's largely due to all of this passive aggressiveness. So I want to close with, people say, well, what would you do? How would you handle this? And I'm just going to say that the biggest problem in politics in the United States is that the old labels do not apply to anything. So there is no such thing as a conservative in the United States. There is no such thing as a Republican conservative in the United States, unless you view Democrats and Republicans as both being conservative. In other words, both parties seek to maintain the status quo at different levels of intensity. So the Democratic Party has a series of things that they want to do that involve basically pulling and using government power to take guns away or to give people free education or to solve homelessness or whatever the issue is, to deal with the drug problem, to deal with border and immigration issues, whatever their plans are. It usually involves pooling resources or increasing government power. So on the Republican side, on the same issues, they want to do the same thing. So President Trump wants to build a wall, and if the House won't build it for him, then he's going to go to the military to build it, because we can already fund that. And so we're going to use government power to do things. We're going to use executive power to get things done, even though the Republicans decried the use of executive power by President Obama, let's say. So what you have is a situation where the both political parties in this country are actually collectivist and statist oriented. Statist is one of those terms that's thrown out a lot, but basically they're state centric. They want the power to do things. And the Republicans say we're better at it than the Democrats because we believe in capitalism and we believe. But they don't, because what they're doing is strengthening government power. And that is an anathema to capitalism. So that's what you have. And what you have is a lot of religious motivation and a lot of people who think they're conservative because they believe in Jesus or they're Christian or they're against abortion or any of these things. And they want to use government power to accomplish the things that they want to accomplish. So if you believe in liberty and freedom, so if you are a person who literally wants to have a less government power, and you believe in the idea that government power is potentially pernicious and dangerous, then, and you want to clear out the quote-unquote rat's nest of government power, you're actually a liberal. You're not a conservative. And if you believe in holding your legislators accountable, and you believe in a series of ideas that are involved with basically capitalism and freedom, then you are a liberal. You are not a conservative. And that's the biggest problem. We use these labels. If I've seen one Republican say that they're conservative and then talk about how it's okay to build a Viking stadium, or a Republican who says, well, I'm all for cutting the budget, but we're going to have to increase funding for education because we got kids in this community that need dot, dot, dot. So what happens is they go to the Capitol and they get pushed in the middle part of the direction or even over to the left. And you have these Republican politicians who will always vote for more funding for medical stuff and insurance, because the insurance companies are a huge lobby in the state. They will always vote for education because the education lobbies are a huge influence in the state. And they will do everything they can to continue the concentration of power. They aren't against interlocking councils, Venetian style of unelected suzerains who decide where to put the trains. They aren't against the chambers of commerce deciding how we're going to conduct business. And the guys who are super rich who fund these campaigns are also not against that stuff. They are all for maintenance of the status quo. So if the status quo is the problem, then you're a revolutionary. Aha! You're a revolutionary, just like the original founding fathers, who were not conservatives. They were liberals. They were classic liberal and radical liberals for their time. So you people running around talking about turning Minnesota red, you're talking about turning Minnesota into a collectivist paradise, because most of the Republicans are part of the problem. So very quickly, how do you fix that? Well, I think it has to do with personalities, and it has to do with people that are talented enough to make arguments. And this podcast is getting long, but I'm not going to do another one, so I'm just going to keep going. Hopefully, it won't be too long. So one of the reasons that Reagan, for example, and I'm sorry to bring up Reagan, but I will because it fits this particular discussion, was able to do what he did was he spent 8 years working for GE's Simon Boulware, who taught him everything he knew about libertarian and Austrian economics and how to argue with union people. Because the idea was that Reagan was hired as a spokesperson to communicate capitalist ideas to union workers to keep them from unionizing GE plants and to control the direction of union contracts, such as they were at GE during this period of time. And it was very successful. But Reagan took it one step further in that he studied Henry Hazlitt. He studied von Mises. He studied Milton Friedman. He studied libertarian ideas. And he inculcated those ideas into his everyday work. He traveled with a bookcase and read constantly. So that when he made a speech at a union plant, contrary to what a lot of guys would have done, especially in his position as a movie star, they would have left and forgotten about it. But Reagan would stay until the last guy left to have these conversations. patients. Consequently, when he entered politics, he could make the argument. So if you listen to any of Reagan's speeches, they were filled with statistics and they were filled with philosophical ideas. You will never hear that from a Republican in this state, and you'll never hear it from a national Republicans anymore. The closest that we get to it is probably Ted Cruz. Most of the time, these politicians, especially Republicans, but also Democrats, but we're not talking about Democrats here. We're talking about Democrats. We're talking about Republicans. Lean on these themes, religious, social identity, and these ethereal concepts about what America's supposed to be and everything else, which aren't specific. Because if they get specific, you'd say, well, you're just a statist. You're not a Republican. You're not a quote-unquote conservative. Reagan, you knew where he stood because he used specific language, because he'd learned it arguing with union guys for 10 years. And that way, when he said, I paid for this microphone, or there you go again. He said it with authority, and that's why people believed him, aside from the fact that he was exceptionally talented as a communicator, right? So, well, then how would you create a political movement in the state of Minnesota? Well, the problem in the state of Minnesota is you have a group of very wealthy people who are involved in the insurance business and in the medical treatment business and in other businesses that depend on government. And many of them depend on government contracts and grants and things of that nature, real estate, all that stuff. And they are very wealthy, and they do not want to rock the boat. They want to put money into things that will further their business. Or they are billionaires who are one-issue Charlies. That is, they are Christian, anti-abortion, pro-life people, and that is their issue, or something else. So they're one-issue Charlies. And they don't want to create grassroots political movements. They want to create politicians they can control. And if you ask anybody who is at the Capitol, if you look up in the galleys at the Capitol, you will see the lobbyists from the Mayo Clinic and United Health and all the rest of them, you know, glancing down at legislators, nodding to them and telling them what to do from the galley. I mean, everyone talks about that. But the voter never knows that because nobody's ever going to mention that. So finally, very quickly, how do you solve this problem? Well, I think it starts with very expensive social research that determines people's histories, where they came from, where their families came from, what they do, their jobs, asking hundreds and hundreds of people in every Senate district in the state to describe an average day, from the people on the Indian reservations to the people down farming in southern Minnesota, as well as, and again, this can't be done by a party. It's got to be done by academics. To ask them about the things that are important in their lives and the things that they are worried about. And then fleshing those ideas out further through survey research with very large sample sizes, not 500, but 3,000, 4,000, and talking to enough people in each House and Senate district that you can actually have miniature polls from those districts. Finally, somebody has to go back and look at the census data going back to the formation of the state of these people, their families, and the movement of individuals in terms of their social movement and their religious movement and their ancestors. And on top of all that, you have to have a good political analyst who isn't a partisan go through and analyze all that data and lay out some pointers that are non-biased about what is important to those people. And then from that, you can begin to say, okay, we're going to fund a grassroots movement that addresses these ideas. And we're not going to be Republican, and we're not going to be Democrat. It's going to be an independent social movement based on these ideas. That's what has to happen. If we did that in this state, it would make national news eventually. And I think it would be a very, very powerful thing. The other thing you can add to that is to analyze as much data as you can from social media and from any other kind of data mining that you could pull from the same people that you survey to compare their behavior with what they say they do and what their beliefs are versus what they actually do. Everything, up to and including how much porn they watch or, you know, whether or not they smoke pot or any of those things, whether or not somebody in their family had an abortion. This is really important stuff. And what's happening is these political people in this state, for the most part, as Republicans, minorities, they run out and they just think that their conservatives, therefore, their movement is this, that, or the other thing. And that's not how you form movements or market those movements. So if you ask me, that's where we have to start in this state to solve problems. We have to create an environment where confrontation is acceptable. We have to create an argument where conflict can be positive. And we have to have politicians who are talented enough to be able to analyze all that data and to be able to figure out how to communicate that data in a way that Minnesotans can understand it. And by extension, the rest of the country. And until that happens, you're going to get more and more of these derivative movements with people who are self-interested, with derivative ideas about politics, forcing themselves on the public and then doing something completely at odds with what they said they were going to do. And that just creates more dissatisfaction with politics. Now, I don't know what people think. I don't know what people think of this. I think a lot of people are probably pretty upset about some of this stuff. But I do not believe the future is Republican or Democrat. And I think we have to have new thinking about politics based on new ideas. And the only way to get them is we got to go out and actually talk to real people. And they can't know that it's an effort to find out about politics. Pew does it a little bit, but Pew also creates the questions. And so they sit around and describe how would we as academics describe how would we as academics describe a problem? And then they create a question based on that. What I'm saying is go out and talk to people and first create the behavior groups, and then go back and talk to them and find out what's important to them, and then factor in the political stuff. And people say, well, how much would it cost to do that? Probably about $5 to $10 million. But I'll tell you what, you'd have a hella survey once you did it. So that's what I think. Remember, all the printing at thebobdavispodcast.com is handled by Cartridge World because I don't like expensive laser cartridges. Cartridge World of Maple Grove can give you up to 30% off compared to the big box stores. Their cartridges are better, in my opinion, than the factory delivered ones. Free delivery and qualifying orders. They're in Maple Grove off of Weaver Lake Road. Click on the banner at the top of the page, thebobdavispodcasts.com, or call Jason at 763-420-6632. Cartridge World. Thanks again for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn. I appreciate the likes and the shares and the favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter, and for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. We are also on Spotify, blogtalkradio.com, and it is always good to listen to the podcast right off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 786. Bye-bye.
Take a seat. Right over there, sat on the stairs, stay or leave. The cabinets are bare and I'm unaware of just how we got into this mess. Got so aggressive, I know we meant all good intentions. So pull me closer, why don't you pull me close? Why don't you come on over, I can't just let you go. Oh baby, why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little.